We're pleased to welcome back to the program here this morning Dennis Barron, who's professor of English at University of Illinois, who has from time to time been stopping by here on this program to talk about language, the English language in particular.
In particular.
He is interested in many different sorts of things, including attempts that have been made over time to change the language, politics that have to do, issues that have to do with politics and language, things like movements to have languages declared to be official, as there have been attempts here in this country to have English declared the official language in the country. So when he's here, we give you an opportunity to do a number of things. If you have questions about grammar, you're invited to call and he'll see if he can help you out. It's also an opportunity to complain, and people do, about misuse.
Do I get to complain?
You get to complain, too. Okay. The only guy who doesn't get to complain is me.
Oh, go on.
Well, I hate to complain, but maybe I will later. And
was that a complaint?
Oh, I think it was. Well, see, now there you go. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's always great to be here, David.
All right. Okay.
Now that we got that out of the way.
So when does the fun start?
I think it already has.
Okay.
We can listen to the tapes later and find out when precisely we started having fun.
Yes.
I'm sure it'll start with the very first call.
Okay.
We don't have any yet. When we do these programs, people do call and complain.
They do.
And people, I suppose, the people have been complaining about the decline in language in usage for always, ever.
As far as we know. I mean, nobody really says, hey, things are getting better language-wise. You know, sometimes the economy has been known to get better. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, the weather has been known to get better.
Language never gets better.
You know, somebody wants to come in and say, hey, things are really looking up. That would be, you know, something noteworthy, something unusual.
Well, given that,
man bites dog.
Always complain.
Dog bites man. You know,
is the language actually declining? I don't even know how you would go about answering a question like that, really.
No.
Adherence to the rules?
Language is not declining what are the measures for inclining and declining, going up and going down? Okay, you mentioned adherence to the rules. So people who think that other people are not adhering to the rules, I suppose that's a measure of declination. That's a measure of things are getting worse.
But there have always been people that
not very good around here anymore.
Other people were not adhering to the rules.
Yeah. It's always somebody else who's making the mistakes. It's never me. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are other measures, too. More people than ever are speaking English. Mm-hmm. Now, that's partly a function of there being more people than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's also a function of English spreading its influence around the world. I mean, these are not just people in the U.S. and the U.K. and the former colonies of Australia, New Zealand, those sorts of places, Nigeria. These are places all around the world where people are acquiring some English, a lot of English, an intermediate amount of English, a smattering of English. It's popular.
Well, there are language. Some people would argue the Australians only have a smattering of English.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course,
in America, they haven't spoken it for years, if you want to quote the line from My Fair Lady. But, yeah, I mean, there's another measure that says that, you know, if it's declining, how come more people are using it?
Mm.
The other thing is the vocabulary keeps increasing. Okay, there's another measure. Probably, could be looked at as a sign of health. Vitality, the fact that people are using language enough to invent new words and to embed them in their conversation. Not you know, a lot of the new words are technical terms that no one ever really gets to hear or use except specialists, but a lot of them are also words that make their way into our everyday talk. So, yeah, there's another measure that things are okay.
Mm. You want to talk with some folks who are on the phone here?
Let's go to the phones.
Okay.
To coin a phrase.
Line one, Champagne.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I have two quick questions. One, the use of I versus me, my friends and I versus my friends and me. Mm-hmm. Everyone says my friends and I had heard that it's actually my friends and me. And also, my students today, we were talking about using words like and I mean and
you know.
As and I, they said, what are those for? Why are they so prevalent? And the best I could give them was, it's a stalling technique while we formulate a thought. Mm-hmm. And if I've made myself clear, I'll hang up and listen.
Yes, right. I think so.
Okay,
first, the I me quandary. Sometimes it's I and sometimes it's me. It depends typically on whether it is subject or object for the pronoun. We still make a distinction in our pronouns between things that go in front of the verb that function as subjects, things that go behind the verb or after prepositions, or in what we call object positions. So that tends to conflict with a sense that many people have that I is more correct than me. Hmm. Across the board, regardless of where it comes. So people will say, between you and I, where technically between is a preposition, so the pronouns that come after it should be objects. But so many people do it that it's a fairly common thing to hear, particularly in American English, has been for a few decades now. And the people who follow the rules say, no, that's wrong, should be between you and me. So there's an example. Is it a rule that's being broken? Is it a new rule that's being created, a new idiom in the sense that between you and I, as an idiom, doesn't have to obey grammatical rules. Idioms don't obey grammatical rules.
Hmm.
They go off on their own. So, yeah, like and you know, to answer the second part of the question, we call them fillers. They are stalling techniques in one sense, as the caller said, to give us some space to think of what comes next. And they are also cues to the people we are talking with that we're not done yet. We are in the process of formulating another part of the response. So don't steal my turn in the conversation quite yet. I remember when I was a little kid in school, the place markers were things like and and teachers would drill us to not say those, to suppress them and to use silence instead. And the problem with silence is, of course, that someone else can just come in and step on your lines. While you're thinking of the next thing, thinking that you have given up your speech turn, the coast is clear for somebody else to say something.
Do all languages have them, as far as you know?
I have no idea. The languages that I know, which are very few, French and a smattering of German, do have placeholders like that. They're sounds, typically. Sometimes they're words, and they function in the spoken language. I mean, the other language I'm familiar with is Latin, but I don't know conversational Latin, so I don't know if... I assume that Romans probably had something that warned other people that they were still talking.
Hmm. All right. Let's talk with someone else, and the next caller is in St. Joe. Line number two.
Hello. First, I'd like to comment on your talk about the decline in grammar and punctuation. One place to find that, I think, really easily is the internet forums. I've only started using them recently, but what I found is that especially amongst teenagers and probably people in their 20s is a complete disrespect for either grammar or punctuation, spelling. And when somebody comments about a lack of it in people's postings, they get really irate and dismissive. And I'm wondering if you see that as well.
Mm, yeah, I have some observations to make about that too. A lot of people complain that the computer and particularly the internet have contributed to the perception that the language is declining. Things like email, things like instant messaging, things like these internet forums that you're talking about. I don't see it that way. I like to look at it a different way, and that is that these are new genres of communication that are developing. And what you see in these genres, like email, like IM, is the development of conventions and speech communities which sort of set the rules as they get formulated and punish anybody who violates them. So there's a way that you're supposed to behave online, and there's a way you're supposed to behave in email. And if you violate that convention, they either make fun of you, or they flame you, or they trash you, or they write to you offline and say, you know, this is not how we do things around here, so, you know, shape up, buddy.
Right.
And, you know, as these things get more widespread, they become more conventional in a more traditional sense of convention. Email, when it started out, you know, you could either write on a computer in capital letters or lowercase letters. You couldn't shift between them. And so a convention arose to write only in lowercase letters. But computers became a little more flexible, you know, since the late 1960s, I think, when the first email started getting used. And you see that email is now much, much like a conventional letter. And in the older technologies, email programs will come with spell checkers, for example, which is obviously a sign that people think they should pay attention to their spelling when they're writing emails. Now, if you're dashing off a note, whether you're using a piece of paper or a computer, you're going to be less formal. If you're writing a letter of complaint or an application, whether it's on a typewriter or on a computer, you're going to be more formal. So those are the kinds of things. People do observe conventions, and you don't want to mistake one kind of thing where it's sort of a badge of honor to misspell words and to not punctuate and to use abbreviations. In one context, they're not going to use it in another context.
I think you're right. I think that some of the informality and the misspelling and lack of attention to grammatical and spelling detail is a kind of attitude that's being expressed. And what I find ironic, though, is these folks who, at least most of them, probably have some experience with computer programming, which requires absolute precision in one's writing, and they're showing no respect for precision in how they're writing in regular English, which I just think that's funny.
Well, it depends on what you mean by precision, too, because, I mean, you're saying that bad spelling is imprecise, but if you're using it intentionally to get a certain kind of point across and to say, you know, I'm a wild and crazy guy when I'm writing this stuff, that's a kind of precision, right? Because you've got an intention and you've got a reaction to it. I mean, that's using language to get an effect.
I guess whatever works. But on another note, I don't know if you've talked about this on previous shows, but have you talked about the word homophobe and how it came about and how it came to be adopted and how bizarre it is that a word that literally means fear of homosexuality or homosexuals would be seen as derisive since we don't we don't condemn people for other fears, whether it be arachnophobes or others. Why is this particular, how did this particular word become so adopted so readily?
I don't really know anything about the history of the word homophobe, other than to say that it has become more widespread in the last 10 years or so, maybe even longer than that. I could say that it probably marks a kind of sense that it's not appropriate to make negative comments about homosexuality.
It
reflects a sort of change in the culture toward homosexuality.
Sure. Is the use of that particular word and its literal definition, if you look at it. I don't know, we all know that P-H-I-L-E means a lover of whatever you want to put before it. Mm-hmm. Is there an equivalent of the opposite that could have been used instead of someone being a phobe?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. I mean, you could think of some other suffix to put on there that would function as well, but for some reason, maybe the pattern of, you know, blank plus phobe is strong enough that people just went with that.
Yeah. Kind of related recently in a forum. It might have been an article, it might have been a forum item, but someone that I was expressing disdain for someone else, even using the word homosexual as if they were using an equivalent of the N-word. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've run into that at all.
Well, words take on taboos. You know, words that are. I think what's probably going on here, what you're probably referring to, is the fact that we use polite terms or euphemisms to refer to things that also have nasty or taboo variants associated with them as a way to, you know, avoid the taboo, but to still say what you're trying to say. But the euphemism, the polite term, often gets tarred with the same brush, and so it acquires a kind of taboo. Maybe that's what you're talking about, and so that becomes, you know, an uncomfortable word to use, and you have to invent a new euphemism for it. It's a kind of cycle that a lot of these words go through.
One final thing. I'm wondering if you've heard of a piece of software that's online on a website called GoCreate.com, which is an interesting website that tries to encourage creativity. But it's a software that generates random. It's a random word generator,
mm-hmm.
and people who use the website are invited to offer up definitions of these non-existent words. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of this at all?
Absolutely not. No, have not seen it.
Okay, we can just go to GoCreate.com, but can I give a couple of examples that I think are interesting?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sure, okay, here's one. It's spelled E-G-O-Z-I-D-E-N-C-E. I guess it would be pronounced egovidence, and the given definition, proof of one's narcissism.
Uh-huh.
Another one, ironic. Even. An adjective expressing ironic eroticism.
Mm-hmm.
Exalticide. The killing of any chance of a person might have of having had, of living up to your expectations by thinking so highly of them. I just thought those are some interesting, I guess, kind of similar to Rich Hall's Sniglets, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, people like to make up these funny words, and every once in a while one of them will catch on. It's true. So
all right.
You can always hope.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Our
guest this morning here in this part of Focus 580 is Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at University of Illinois. And occasionally he's here on the show. We talk about language. And if you have questions, comments about language, use, misuse, how it changes, how it is resistant to change, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope this makes sense as a question, but are there any rules in regards to the sense, quote-unquote, the mistakes we make? And I'll throw out a couple of examples, like ain't instead of am not or are not. I just wonder if the changes themselves follow some sort of mm-hmm. pattern themselves. Mm-hmm. And secondly, most of the words that are not being used or sort of drop out of the dictionaries now, are they mostly words from Latin? And one of my mm-hmm. favorite words when I was younger was sesquipedalian.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to use that a lot, and I used to upset people because they thought I was being a little haughty. But I just sort of, after I studied Latin, it sort of interested me, and I still use if I were, you know, a special case for the... I think they call it the pluperfect or something like that years ago. And I've been corrected, actually, in the library, saying that's not correct. It's if I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to get into a long argument with some young person who, you know, still was in, you know, basically high school. But I was wondering about those aspects of language,
sure.
if they follow certain rules, whether the droppings or the changings mm-hmm. or anything mm-hmm. like that, if mm-hmm. anything sensible can be said about that. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, because things that get labeled as mistakes in language or breakings of the rules tend to follow kinds of patterns. I mean, if you look at them, you analyze them, you sort of see why something particular happens. Why is there ain't? I mean, why does ain't exist? And why are people saying such terrible things about it? Well, one of the reasons why ain't exists, and if it didn't exist, people would invent it, is because it fills a gap in the syntactic structure of English. We have for the second person plural, we have aren't. You aren't. Okay, for the third person singular, he isn't, she isn't, it isn't. We have for the plural, they aren't. But for the first person, and for the first person plural, we have we aren't. But for the first person singular, my own language, when I try to decline, well, actually, those are conjugations, not declinings, falls apart. The first person singular, I am not. Okay, so over and over again, people have invented I am-n't. Am-n't I? And I ain't falls in that category. In fact, it's interesting to look at comments on ain't in the 19th century, even the early part of the 20th century. People said, well, you know, it does fill a role, and I guess it's okay as long as you restrict it to the first person singular. When it's really wrong, the critics would say, is when you say he ain't or she ain't or they ain't. I ain't is okay, but you know, don't use it anywhere else.
They ain't, no.
And eventually, the I ain't became stigmatized and as well. And so that's sort of out. Now, despite the fact that it's kind of logical, it's kind of regular in the sense that regular means to follow a rule. Okay, so there's that. Yeah, these variants, these irregularities, these so-called mistakes very often follow kinds of predictable patterns. They fill a need. Even performance errors, like when I start flubbing when I'm saying something. I mean, if you analyze the situation, I mean, there are a variety of reasons why you trip over certain words and not others, or in certain contexts, or rather than others. So it turns out that there's a lot of stuff going on that is patterned in terms of what we do with our language. Even the stuff that seems to break the patterns that people require really are.
But see, aren't there cases where if someone is departing from the norm, in some cases what they're doing is they're taking a rule that they know and they're extending it to another situation where it doesn't work, but where they're trying. So in their mind, they're probably trying to be correct. They're following they're taking some rule that applies in one place and they're saying, well, if it works over there, maybe it'll work over here.
Right. You know, this is one of Barron's laws of usage, which is that...
Is that copyrighted?
No, it's trademarked.
All right, then.
No, I don't know. It's just something I make up from time to time. If you insist that people follow a rule, and I'm talking about language now, I'm not talking about the speed limit or other kinds of rules. If you insist that people follow a particular rule, eventually somebody is going to make a mistake thinking that, you know, okay, the way I used to say it, everybody said I was wrong. I've got to say it the way it's supposed to be correct, so I'm going to say it the correct way. And what they think is the correct way actually turns out to be a mistake. So you know, insisting on correctness actually contributes to making new mistakes. Mm-hmm. We call this a process of hypercorrection, overcorrection. And sesquipedalian, as our caller said, is a pretentious word. It's meant to be a pretentious word, and it means, and I do this in class every time I teach pretension, sesqui means one and a half in Latin. So sesquicentennial is a one and a half hundred, right? So sesquipedalian is 1.5 feet. It's a foot and a half long word.
Ah.
Okay, so it's using a long word when a short word would do.
It's a good word.
It's a long word to describe long words.
I think for the rest of the day, we should all try to use it.
Sure. Just don't trip over it.
Dennis Barron here, our guest. We have several other callers. If you have questions about language, that's what we're here all about. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. He should know. That's why he's here. That's why
I
they call
know.
Him Dr.
Right.
Grammar.
That's my slogan. The I should know. Should
know.
I should
Barron,
know.
He should know.
Right. I mean, I should know.
Let's talk with someone else. Let's go to Charleston. A caller on from Charleston here, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about the generic use of the word you rather than I. For example, in a sentence like this, where I would say, I know you shouldn't break the rules, but sometimes you break them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I really mean to say, I know I shouldn't break the rules, but sometimes I break them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I often use the word you, and I'm wondering which is correct there.
Well, either one. I mean, one of the things that we do is generalized, so we're referring to partly to ourselves, but we're also referring to people in general, ought to. So when we say you as a generic there, you shouldn't go over 65 or whatever the speed limit happens to be. You could say we shouldn't. I mean, you could be inclusive. I mean, you is sort of, you know, sets up an opposition between me and other people. I shouldn't break the rules, you know, it draws the attention to the speaker, and we, you know, is more inclusive. But I think it's just sort of conventional to say, you know.
Okay, so I'm not breaking any rules by using that, then.
No, you're not.
Great,
you're
thank
not.
You.
Use it, enjoy it.
I will.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to line number 1. This is the next caller, Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'd just like to get your comments on the overuse of the word issues. You could hear that a lot these days.
You got an issue with that?
Yeah, I do, actually.
You mean
Let's just stick to the issues here.
In the sense, are you talking about like, you know?
Oh, yeah, he has issues.
Issues.
Yeah, like that. That kind of usage, as opposed to, you know,
politicians stick
to the issue. Yeah.
Right. Well, even then, because now you hear it a lot more and more and more. And in one other...
To say he has issues means, you know, it's a euphemism for saying the guy's nuts.
Right.
Right?
It started out, I think, in the computer world where programs had issues.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And now
meant that there were glitches, bugs.
Right. As opposed to using the word glitches or conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I just wanted to pass that on. That's... irritating to me to hear it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And one other one, just real quickly, the use of the word absolutely.
Oh,
without
for sure, saying, for sure,
without that, saying absolutely not or absolutely yes.
For sure, that's a problem. Yeah.
So, anyway, just a couple of things so people can think about that.
All right. Thank you.
The call.
Yeah, things that get repeated like that. He's got issues. She's got issues. Absolutely, they get annoying. People don't like it. We don't like it. You don't like it.
So
I don't
do
like
it.
So don't do it. Yeah, that's the problem, is getting people not to do what you don't like.
Well, right? Language,
I mean, it's an
words,
issue of control.
It's a fad kind of thing.
It's a fad kind
words
of thing.
Words become popular. We like to use them.
They'll
then they become
eventually.
Overused, and then we'll go on to something else.
Yeah, because one of the rules of information theory is that the more frequently a piece of information is mentioned, the more frequently a word is used, the less it means. It becomes so common you hardly even notice it in the context. And so eventually people who want to actually mean something will look for an alternative of some kind. You get tired of you get tired of hearing it, but people get tired of saying it too. And so, you know, someone will come along with a substitute instead of saying, you know, it's got issues, he's got issues, they'll say something else.
Say something else. To go back to the call, the man who called from Indiana, he also asked the question about why is it when words go away, when we stop using them, why?
Yeah, why? And where do they go?
Well, so, and of course, some of them come back because, in fact, there are words that we think are new.
Is there an afterlife?
I don't want to get into those kinds of issues.
No.
On this program.
No, not on this program. That'll be, you know, the Sunday.
That's right. Keeping the faith.
Keeping in the faith.
Steve can worry about where words go.
Steve can worry about that. Where do words go when we're done with them?
We're secular humanists here.
So it's not only Latin words that leave English. In fact, you know, some of the words that left English are the oldest words in the language. A lot of the words from Old English never made it into Middle and Modern English. They just died out. So why do words die out? Why? You know, one of the interesting things is that you don't notice that a word is gone until you suddenly get reminded of it, either by encountering it in an old context or somebody says, gee, I never hear the word such and such anymore. Mm-hmm. Why is that? They become no longer necessary. Okay, so either they get upgraded. I mean, if technology changes, for example, we don't have a lot of the terms that we used to have for different kinds of horse and buggies, right? I mean, there were all kinds of designs for carriages that horses would draw. Then they had particular terms, and you see, you know, what is a brougham? What is a, you know, whatever those other things are? That you will find them in a Victorian novel, for example, or in an old newspaper article, or in a museum.
Okay. A few of them were passed on to automobiles.
Exactly. Some of them get upgraded to the new technology. So the car replaces the horse and buggy. So those lines and terms for certain kinds of garments we don't use anymore. Stuff like that. Or we use them, you know, we sort of revive them.
Very good.
Very good.
We have a number of other callers. Absolutely. And we will continue and talk next with someone in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Absolutely. I think the hidden word is perfectly acceptable. They have it in almost every language where you agree with somebody and there's a certain frame of reference for it. But that's not what I meant to talk about. I just was loading up on what you said. I am one of those people who think language is getting better.
Ah, okay, okay.
Put a check mark in your column because it lets you be more expressive. You got more options.
More options.
And I realize that if you went and saw the best-selling movie last week, which was Hero, one of the contentions there was that there were 19 or 20 different ways to write the word sword in Chinese.
Write the word sword.
Right.
Okay.
Different characters. And one of the things the new emperor was going to do was make it one.
Mm.
Not quite in the same boat as Charlemagne, you know, back before the year 1000, which I think was great that Carolingian minuscule writing standardized so you could at least read what somebody wrote from another country or another part of your country. But if you have lots of different words for one thing, that encourages a much wider range of expression. And for some people, that's a necessity. Like the Eskimos are supposed to have 20 different words for different kinds of snow.
Yeah, actually, they don't.
They don't.
That's a myth. That's a language myth.
Well,
they
you're
don't
the
have
expert.
20. Yeah,
no,
yeah. I mean, I always.
I grew up near there, so I'm going to disagree with you.
Well, it's been exploded. You know, they have expressions to characterize different kinds of snow, but it's all, you know, essentially snow.
Okay, maybe it's a phrase. Or
yeah,
maybe
that's what it is. Yeah, we have and our you know our equivalent is all the different words we have for hamburger.
Okay, I'm
right. You know, we got cheeseburgers, we got mushroom burgers, we got soy burgers, we got turkey burgers. We do the same thing. Language is flexible.
Well, skiers have lots of words for snow too.
So they have lots of words for broken leg.
Broken leg. Is that what you're saying? Broken leg?
You got your compound fracture.
You got your simple fracture. You got your compound fracture. You got your, you know.
Okay, then you got your simple words and your compound words.
Yeah.
That's what the illusions do with the snow.
Yeah.
It's necessary. And whether you call it a compound word or two words, you're the expert, but I'm going to go.
That's always allowed on this show. We allow that.
Yeah, I like those kinds of comments.
But just artistically speaking, the wider the range of the palette, the more you can do with the language. If you're really going to enforce, I mean, what do you call it, poetic license? You know, when the poets bend the language a little bit to say something that couldn't be said some other way. You have a lot more of that with flexible language.
Right. And English has, you know, for a long time now, since at least the Renaissance, has had the largest vocabulary of any of the world's languages. I mean, there's almost 500,000 words in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Right, like other languages don't do puns the same way we do.
Well, you know, there's a lot more synonymy because of that, and there's a lot more nuance. And the downside argument would be, yeah, it creates a lot of confusion, makes the language harder to learn. I don't know. That's the way it is. And that's the way it developed, and it seems to continue to be developing in that direction of large vocabulary, lots of choices.
Oh, okay. Good. Glad to hear it.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm glad you agree.
A vote for things getting better.
Yeah.
And yada, yada, yada.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Okay.
Is it true that the average person's vocabulary, the number of words they know, has over time, has that been getting bigger? Or is it about the same as when Shakespeare was around?
The problem with that is we don't really have any way to measure that. Right. There's a lot of argument about what constitutes the average person's vocabulary size today. I mean, I see studies that say that start at 40,000 words for the average American high school graduate and go up to 50, 60, 70, 80, or even 100,000. Words. It depends whether you mean words that you recognize or words that you use. It depends on how you define what actually is a word. You know, is am one word and are another word and be a third word, or are they all part of one word that means to be? So the way you count them, but I mean, yeah, people have large vocabularies now. We have no way really of knowing what the spoken vocabulary of people in the past might have been. We can infer from the words that survive on the page. But how accurate is that? I don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line 3.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I want to say congratulations to the gentleman who called about if I was.
Mm.
Oh,
subjunctive.
That irritates me so. Mm-hmm. I studied English grammar and Old English, and I've always thought it was if I were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, and then the other thing that irritates me when I listen to the local radio station talking about two teams and then the loser team, they say, and they got beat by.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that just, I almost turn off the radio. You can't say they were beaten by because they would be pulp, but
I see. But you know,
another way of saying it, they lost to the opposing team or something like that, but they got beat by.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
It's one way of saying it. One of the things that, I mean, there's a couple things going on here. I think one of them is that the language of sports casting tends to be, at least today, and probably for some time has been, more informal than the language of other kinds of reportage on the radio and on TV. The other thing is that sports casters, or just people in general, because words like beat, beaten, defeated, lost, and one are, you know, there really aren't too many of those words. They're looking for alternate ways of expressing, especially if you're reading a long list of games results. So you want to vary your vocabulary or people fall asleep. So they trounce, they get trounced, they get, you know, there's all kinds of inventive phrases that sportscasters or sports writers come up with to refer to the contests on the field. And there's going to, you know, talk about an expanding word hoard. There's an example where people are constantly looking to invent new ways of reporting which team won and which team lost.
Well,
so the combination of the informality and the fact that you have to keep varying your language to keep people awake.
Well, that keeps me awake. They got beat by.
Ah, okay. Well, another sports fan.
Well, not so much, except when it's the radio. I'm turn it on Monday morning to see what happened. And mm-hmm. I turn it off as soon as.
Now, if we can figure out a way to do this with the commodity reports.
Oh. Yeah,
vary the vocabulary. It probably just can't happen.
I don't think
right?
there's a way to make that exciting to people who aren't interested in that information.
Yeah.
I'm afraid so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
I would like to have you on more often on the radio.
Well, we'll see what we can do about it. Thanks
Please
for the
do.
Call.
Thank you.
The issue of...
Henry Frayne is saying, no, keep them off the air.
The issue of was and were is it's still, I guess I find myself confused, too. If I were to have done something, if I was to have done mm-hmm. something.
Yeah. You know, we use were as a subjunctive for what we call conditions contrary to fact.
So you're talking to somebody that something that might have happened
yeah,
but did not.
But didn't, yeah.
Then you
or could happen in the future, but you know, hasn't happened. If I were to make a prediction about the election, yeah, that sort of condition contrary to fact. Now people have been predicting the death of the subjunctive, particularly were, for hundreds of years in English, and it hasn't. I mean, it's the. The verb form that refuses to die, wouldn't die. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't use it, particularly in informal contexts. There's a lot more wases where they used to find was, maybe even 30, 40 years ago. But it's still there. Hmm. It still pops up enough that you can say, yeah, it's you know, it hasn't died. It's not on its deathbed. It's, you know. How unhealthy is it? Not terribly. You know,
it's in stable condition?
It's in stable condition.
We'll issue reports periodically.
Periodically. It's like whom, you know. We still say whom once in a while.
No, but I think only to in a sesquipedalian sort of way.
Even dyed in the wool who-sayers. You'll if you listen to them long enough, they'll come up with a whom. They'll find a situation where a whom has to be there.
I see. Let's go on.
Not dead yet.
Not
not dead yet.
No, I'm not. Line number 4. The caller is in southeastern Illinois. Hello.
We can board a plane. We can board a train. We can board a ship. It's all right as long as we haven't bored the audience.
Uh-huh.
We try to, although this show often, one of our mottos over the years has been Focus 580, the show that dares to be dull.
Okay.
So we're not afraid of boring the audience.
Yeah, the many things have, while I've been waiting, have I got about 30 seconds?
We'll give you a minute and a half.
Okay. A couple of comments on other things. On where words went to, where words have gone to, that's for another program with a man that I may have missed him, but you haven't had him on for some time. The elderly gentleman that...
Marchand.
Oh, Professor Marchand.
Yeah. Jim Marchand, yeah.
Another thing, and you...
He does where they come from. I'm not sure he does
where
they
go,
to.
Yeah. Okay. I couldn't have... I couldn't hear your answer too much, so you may have mentioned this, but that woman called in about... you shouldn't cross the street before looking both ways mm-hmm. and so forth. You is not a substitute for I. It's a substitute for one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we don't use one. I mean, one seems very stilted. And
Americans don't like one. The Brits still use one a lot more. Americans never really cottoned to it.
Another thing you were talking about, ain't. I remember a Masterpiece Theater years ago, some... woman has an upper-class detective, Peter something.
Peter Wimsey. Lord Peter Wimsey says
says and,
yes.
The host to...
but only in the first person singular.
The Masterpiece Theater said that the use of ain't was common among the upper class in England. I want to get to my question, though, that something that I have heard popping up And I've misheard it in places where it wasn't, you know, they wouldn't be using bad English, but it seemed to me something I hadn't heard before. The use of the word awoken.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Rather than where I would say awakened. I mean, he had awoken.
Right, right. That's been going on for years. It's a tricky thing in English. Nobody feels comfortable, I think. That's my assessment. Nobody feels comfortable. There isn't one word. I awaked. I awakened. I awoke. We never quite know what to say, and whatever comes out, comes out, you know. And awoken is just one of those things that comes out in those.
Bit of awakened.
Yeah.
Is there a preferential...
Well, you know, I looked up the history of these words once, but I don't remember it very clearly now. I would have to check again. But, you know, one of them might be an older form that has sort of fizzled lately. I'm suspecting, vaguely recollecting, that awoken is a kind of older variant.
What are the four forms of the word to drink?
Oh, yeah. You mean drink, drank, drunk, and drunken?
Is that it? Drunk and drunken?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what people use?
I drink... I drank, I've drunk deeply, and then the past participle is drunken, as in, you know, what do you do with the drunken sailor?
Well, that's an adjective, though.
Well, but it's from the verb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The drunk and drunken are...
it's like shrink, shrank, shrunk. Yeah. Shrunken, shrunken
head. Well, the word drunk, though, has the stigma of intoxication.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
makes it one think that a better form should be found.
Ah, yes. Okay. Well, there's a challenge.
Okay.
We could have a contest.
Yeah. But what would be the prize?
What would the prize be? A case of beer.
Okay. Get to work on it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. I think we're about at the point we're going to have to stop. And my apologies. We have some callers we cannot mm-hmm. take. Mm-hmm. But on another day, we'll have Dennis come back. I think we decided the last time you're here was the 8th of June. So that's sort of a long time. So maybe we won't let it go quite so long. And I should, if the listener who sent me the materials about bring and take is listening, I have given them to Dennis so he can take a look at them. I just thought I would hold on to them until the next time I saw him. So here, yeah. I passed that on.
He brought them to me.
And he will take them away with
him.
And
I will take them away.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
Dennis Barron, professor of English, University of Illinois. Every once in a while he's here. We talk about language.